Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Black Seas by T.K. Blackwood, narrated by Kyle Tate. 1. Late October 1992. A soft breeze rustled the branches of the birch trees overhead, sending dappled sunlight dancing across the forest floor, creating patterns of shadows, which Corporal Ingrid Karlsdotter followed with a predator's lethal grace. The tall grass whispered against her boots and trousers, the black muzzle of her rifle trained unerringly ahead. She was grateful for the breeze, keeping the ambient noise of the forest just loud enough to partially drown out some of her movements, as she crept slowly uphill, step by careful step. In peacetime, she'd been an avid hiker, trekking up and down trails across Sweden. The weather was picture perfect, especially for this time of year, though Karlsdotter couldn't allow herself to properly enjoy it. She wasn't out here for pleasure. Her platoon moved with her, fanned out in combat deployment, weapons ready. Just weeks ago, they had been weekend warriors. Soldiers in name only. Now, the platoon survivors had seen enough combat to truly be soldiers. Karlsdotter paused in cover behind a narrow birch tree. Its white, papery bark rasped on her fatigues. She peered around the trunk and up toward the gravel road just ahead. Her heartbeat a steady rhythm in her chest. The sound, like war drums in her ears. The rising thrill within her was shadowed by mounting fear in her gut. But above it all was the smoldering furnace of anger in her heart. She tightened her hold on the grip of her rifle and resisted the urge to wipe the sweat from her face. It wasn't hot. If anything, the opposite. But nerves always got the better of her just before combat. She couldn't help but think about all the time she had gone hunting with her father when she was a little girl. It wasn't so different from this. In better times, she had crept through the woods and the mountains, hunting for deer, or hares, or moose. All that had changed was the prey. She rested her rifle in the crook of a branch to steady it, drawing a bead on her target. Her prey stood 50 meters distant, a Soviet infantryman standing watch at the edge of the road beside a BTR armored personnel carrier. His sentry keeping was sloppy. Karlsdotter watched as he smoked and scanned the tree line anxiously. He was jittery and on edge, but his fear wasn't making him more observant. His gaze jumped around at random. He was tense, afraid. Probably thinking every tree hid a Swede with murderous intent. In this case, he was right. The rustling of the trees hid the movement of Karlsdotter's platoon, allowing them to get dangerously close. They'd painstakingly swept these woods looking for stragglers, and once they picked up the scent, it was just a matter of enveloping them and closing in to range. If they had just wanted to wipe them out, it would have been trivial work. Instead, they had a higher purpose for these enemies. It was clear that this particular Soviet detachment wasn't expecting any real danger. They'd been clashing off and on with Swedish forces, but these Soviets had fled from where the front had been. As far as they knew, they were safe this far out. The sentry was perfunctory. They hadn't yet realized they were very wrong. The sentry had an RPG launcher slung on his back and a Kalashnikov in his hands. Even from this distance, Karlsdotter could see the telltale yellow headphone cable of a Sony Walkman cassette player. She knew that they didn't make Walkman in the Soviet Union. She wondered what unfortunate soul he stole that bit of loot from, as she pulled the trigger twice. The gunshots were deafening. The sentry jerked in surprise and dived away, going for cover, even as his body betrayed him by going limp. Carl's daughter managed to put a third shot into him before he hit the ground. Her platoon surged forward and up the hill with a smattering of gunshots to suppress the enemy, and she followed swiftly behind them, her boots digging into the soft earth as she climbed the shallow hill. "Take prisoners!" Sergeant Hellstrom shouted over the gunfire. Living prisoners meant the possibility of gathering intelligence. It was an unwelcome order, but one she intended to obey. Carl's daughter crested the hill and reached the flat plateau of the road. She reached the downed sentry first and knelt by him as the rest of her platoon paired off and secured the remaining Soviets with gunfire and shouted Russian commands to surrender. The sentry flopped limply on the ground, his eyes wide, wild, and searching until they found hers. He gaped his bloody mouth at her, trying to speak, maybe to plead, beg for help. The raw gash her round had torn across his throat precluded any of that. It foamed with red fluid, which spilled down his neck and collar. He was young, maybe just a few years older than her, but the dirt and blood made that hard to tell for sure. Carl's daughter kicked his rifle out of reach as his blood, bright, crimson, and thick, spurted with surprising intensity from the gash in his neck across the gravel road. His struggling grew weaker, his eyes becoming glazed. She watched him as he died, bit by bit, waiting until his kicking legs stopped moving completely. His stolen Walkman sat in a spreading pool of blood, dark Venus mixed with bright red capillary. One less invader to pollute, rape, and pillage her home. She set to work checking the body for intel, tossing his pockets. A half-empty packet of Soviet-made cigarettes followed a military ID into the dirt. She pulled a small wad of Swedish krona from his pocket. The bills were ruined, stained with dark blood, and pierced with a bullet. She let them fall and scatter in the wind around his body. With a grunt and a heave, she rolled him face down into the blood pool and checked his remaining pockets. In one, she found a small notebook. She fished it out and flipped it open, hoping to see notes, maps, orders, anything of value. Instead, the notepad was filled with sketches, drawings, and doodles, a mixture of cartoon characters she recognized and some she didn't. Prominently among them was a roguish wolf with long, unkempt hair and dressed like a Russian sailor. "A wolf," she said, eyeing the soldier's body. "It suits you." Carl's daughter dropped the sketch pad on the dead man and stood back up. The rest of the enemy had been rounded up by her platoon, those that had surrendered quickly enough anyway. She circled the silent BTR to find Hellstrom gathering the Soviet POWs on the side of the road, their hands on their heads. Another soldier in her platoon, Bergman, came to stand beside her as they stared at the POWs.
"Wolves," Carl's daughter said.
Bergman nodded.
"Looks that way."
He thumped the APC with a hand.
"No gas, if you can believe it. I don't see any officers or NCOs with them either."
"Deserters?"
Carl's daughter asked. In truth, she didn't care either way. An invader who followed orders was no different to her than one who didn't. Bergman shook his head.
"I don't think so. I think they were trying to get back to their lines. Who knows?"
Carl's daughter stepped closer to the POWs, eyeing each one of them in turn. There were a half dozen in total, and none of them met her gaze. Each was disheveled, dirty, and tired. Their uniforms were stained and torn, a state made worse by the search they were being subjected to, as each one was checked for weapons and documents. Flak vests, helmets, bandoliers, and webbing. The accoutrements of war were removed with surgical care before being tossed into a growing pile. As the search continued, Carl's daughter watched as military IDs, looted krona, and knickknacks like cigarettes and chewing gum fell around them. A captive soldier at the end of this line of prisoners looked up at her. The hate and fear in his eyes came close to matching her own. She looked at his hands clasped on top of his head and jerked his sleeve down to his elbow, revealing a string of watches decorating his arm. 4 total. Gold and silver, digital and analog. More stolen loot from other Swedes, no doubt. He flashed her a toothy smile that she longed to break with the butt of her rifle. Instead, she pressed the muzzle of the weapon against his belly, pushing hard against his gut as her finger looped the trigger. The Soviet's face drained of color, his confident smile turning to shock in an instant.
"Carl's daughter!" Hellstrom shouted.
She kept the weapon against the Russian's stomach, hot metal on warm flesh. One trigger pull, and she could send another one straight to hell. God knew that these thugs deserved it. God. She thought of the Soviet soldier she'd gunned down in the ditch days prior. She thought of the way he'd gripped his cross necklace, like a drowning man gripping a life preserver. She thought of his limp body and lifeless eyes after she'd finished him off. Hellstrom stopped a short distance away.
Ingrid!
She didn't take her eyes off the Russian she held at gunpoint. Sweat beaded down his face. His once smarmy smirk was now a rictus grin. His teeth were clenched tight as could be. Carl's daughter lowered her rifle, the barrel coming away from the Russian's gut only reluctantly.
"Contraband, Sergeant."
She nodded toward the watches. Hellstrom half turned his head, not taking his eyes from Carl's daughter.
"Booked. Take him."
The trooper stepped forward to strip the looter of his ill-gotten wealth. Hellstrom laid a hand on Carl's daughter's arm and steered her away from the POWs. She waited until they were out of sight of the others before speaking.
"I saw the watches. The way he smiled at me," she said. "I just couldn't."
"I know," Hellstrom cut her off. "But this isn't our job. We aren't barbarians. We aren't animals."
"So we let them do whatever they want," she retorted. "God only knows what they've done to our families, to our homes."
"Then we make the bastards pay," Hellstrom said. "But not these bastards. Their war is over. We log them as looters and send them back for processing. But this war is far from over for us. I need to know I can count on you. I don't need a Viking. I need a soldier."
Carl's daughter exhaled a shaky breath.
"You have one."
Hellstrom's gaze didn't waver.
"Do I?"
She met it evenly.
"Yes."
Hellstrom looked unconvinced. He ran his hand over his braided beard and sighed.
"You're a fighter, Ingrid. A killer. We're going to need people like you. I recommended you for promotion for a reason, but I need to count on you."
She said nothing.
"Do not get yourself wasted on a court-martial. We have rules. Even if they don't, we do. Understand?"
"I understand."
Hellstrom thumped her arm, a show of solidarity.
"Let's beat them first. Then we can make them pay. Yes?"
Ingrid thought of her family, wherever they may be. She thought of her boyfriend, Johan, wondering if he was face down dead somewhere. She took a deep breath and let it out.
Yes, she said. One at a time.
2. Many of the ships in the NATO convoy gathering off Edinburgh had come a long way to be here. For the American vessels in the convoy, they'd traveled across the breadth of the Atlantic Ocean. For the men of HMS Somerset, although Britain was their home, they'd had to sail from their station in the Adriatic to join the growing fleet here. Somerset's closeness to Britain made her mission feel all the more pressing, positioned directly between their home and the war. As a Type 42 guided missile destroyer, Somerset was broadly used for surface warfare, though it also possessed submarine detection equipment. 140 meters long and displacing around 5,000 tons at combat loadout, Somerset held 300 souls in her metal confines. Captain Seymour walked the length of Somerset's operations room, the warship's nerve center. Windowless, cold, and dark, save for the light of the multitude of computer monitors at each station, the operations room was more akin to a computer lab than what most people thought of when they imagined the control center of a ship. It reminded Seymour of the bridge of the Starship Enterprise, more than anything else. As he walked, he pretended not to notice the men hunched over their consoles, hard at work. The murmurs of officers speaking into microphones, gathering and providing information necessary to the functioning of the ship. It did a captain's image good to remain aloof, detached, almost mythical. Seymour found that too much meddling and micromanagement undid that picture. It reminded the men that he was only a man like they were. Seymour was a Navy man from a Navy family. That was to say, he was the child of a naval officer who was also the child of a naval officer. At least 4 consecutive generations of Seymour's family had served in the Royal Navy. It was a tradition his own son was carrying on as a midshipman aboard the HMS Sovereign, though his son had bucked the family tradition somewhat, since Sovereign was a submarine. Seymour used to tease his son about that fact, but right now, he found nothing funny about it. He could only hope his son was safe. Outside, the sea was calm enough for Somerset's kitchen to be serving food, which was often all that could be asked for from the temperamental waters of the North Sea. In times like this, when the crew was busy with their work and there was no immediate threat, it was easy to forget there was a war on. Their compatriots in the anti-submarine arm were busy cruising up and down the Atlantic, hunting for the submarines that still threatened the vulnerable lifeline between Europe and America, as their fathers and grandfathers had done. The weapons were more advanced, and the enemy was different. But the battlefield was the same. Seymour had grown up listening to tales of German submarine and surface raiders, hunting defenseless transport ships in the dark. He'd heard the stories of ships going down with all hands, and stricken U-boats vomiting up roils of dark oil. His father had lived that nightmare. And now, Seymour was about to partake in his own small slice of it. As Somerset and the other frigates and destroyers of the escort group patrolled the mouth of the Firth of Forth, a growing collection of civilian and merchant marine ships gathered in the relative safety of the estuary. Despite all the obvious dangers, Seymour envied the men tasked with patrolling the GIUK Gap and North Atlantic in some ways. Their fight had begun in earnest, and they were free to act, to fight, striking back at Soviet submarines and doing their damnedest to get Allied shipping across the Atlantic intact. Here, Seymour felt like he was little more than a prisoner of circumstance. There was a war going on, and he was missing it. He and the ship had seen some action near the Straits of Taranto during the Yugoslav invasion, firing salvos at Soviet aircraft that dared to risk attack runs on the Adriatic, and probing for submarines. But since then, there had been little in the way of combat, certainly nothing that could compare to the intensity of the fighting in the Adriatic.
"Captain Seymour, sir,"
an ensign said, crossing the operations center.
"You're wanted on the bridge."
Seymour kept his face stony and impassible, but the prospect of something happening was appealing nonetheless.
"Word from Knowles."
The American Oliver Hazard Perry-class frigate Thomas Knowles was the designated convoy leader. It was only on her go that they would weigh anchor. The ensign gave a slight shake of his head.
"Didn't say, sir."
Seymour hid his disappointment.
"Very well."
After turning control over to the duty officer, Seymour left the dark confines of the operations center, heading up for the bridge. The Soviet Northern Fleet, the surface component anyway, had chosen not to sortie in grand style alongside their submarine forces, and instead remained bottled up beyond the northern tip of Norway and the Barents Sea. The reasons for that choice were innumerable, not the least of which was the Soviet Navy's relative weakness when compared to their NATO counterpart. A fleet was not like an army. It was not a weapon to be handled roughly and rebuilt by packing it with conscripts. Sailors were not cannon fodder. They were technical specialists and equipment operators. Ships could take years to build, and were not easily mass-produced like rifles or tanks. In denying NATO a swift surface engagement, the Soviets maintained a fleet in being, a concept nearly as old as national navies themselves. Rather than throwing a weaker fleet away in a futile engagement, it could be kept around in order to force an opponent to dedicate resources to containing it. There was that, and Norway. Seymour arrived on Somerset's bridge and gazed briefly out at the expansive view the forward windows offered. From here, he had an excellent view down the ship's nose, including the Sea Dart launcher just forward of the bridge, its two arms each holding a waiting anti-air missile. Small windscreen wipers which kept the windows free of sea spray in rough seas currently sat motionless. Aside from a lovely view of the ocean, he couldn't see much of the task force with the naked eye, as it was so far spread out.
"Captain on the bridge,"
a sailor called, drawing everyone to attention.
"As you were," Seymour said. "Where's Mr. Smith?"
Seymour asked. The ensign gestured toward the other side of the compartment.
"The XO wanted you to know he'll be with you in a minute, sir. Still talking with the Knowles."
Seymour nodded patiently and moved to the forward section of the bridge, where he took an offered pair of binoculars from a sailor. Gazing out over the ocean, he studied the distant gray form of HMS Gloucester, conducting her own patrol, sweeping for enemy submarines. As he watched, movement overhead caught his eye, a P-3 Orion anti-submarine aircraft on patrol. This close to NATO air bases, friendly air cover would provide a welcome umbrella of protection against two prongs of the Soviet anti-ship force, submarines and aircraft. Once the convoy got further out, they would be more reliant on carrier-based aircraft. Carriers could provide a measure of air cover, but carrier-based fighters generally struggled to compete with their more numerous and more heavily armed land-based counterparts. In that sense, the air bases that dotted Norway gave the NATO allies a huge degree of control over the Norwegian Sea, making any Soviet sortie out of the Barents Sea a risky proposition. So long as those bases stood, the Soviets couldn't safely enter the Norwegian Sea, let alone the North Sea.
"Captain,"
Seymour's XO Smith came to stand beside him.
"Word from Knowles."
Smith's professional facade cracked, just enough to show the hint of a smile. For as long as he'd served with Smith, Seymour rarely knew him to speak or act casually. Some officers might have found him overly stiff, but Seymour actually appreciated the formality. Smith wasn't afraid to speak his mind or challenge Seymour when necessary, but he always did so with a strict professionalism.
"We're waiting on one last ship to finish loading. Million."
"Million," Seymour repeated.
"Which one is that?"
"Cruise ship, sir."
"That's right."
Seymour had seen it when it arrived in Edinburgh the day prior. Million's hull was a pristine, gaudy white. Recently nationalized by an act of Congress, it carried humanitarian and food aid intended for Norway, like the other ships of the convoy. Meals, blankets, heaters, warm clothes, medicine, the bulk of America's plenty, directed to help people in need. Once unloaded, it would assist with evacuating civilians to Britain, shuttling back and forth with as many as it could hold.
"Quite a motley collection of ships we've got here," Seymour said.
"Yes, sir."
"And the escorts? Us, Gloucester, Knowles, Fuchs. Who am I forgetting?"
"Callenberg, sir."
"Callenberg, yes."
Callenberg was a Dutch Courtenaire class. Like Gloucester, she was built for anti-submarine action.
"Did Knowles give any indication of when they expected we would be moving out?"
"None, sir."
"Americans," Seymour muttered. "Expect us to jump on command, don't they?"
"Yes, sir."
"It's 17 hours from here to Bergen at good speed."
Seymour grimaced. "God knows what the merchant ships can maintain."
"Yes, sir."
With Norway's capital of Oslo a straight shot from occupied Denmark and the mouth of the Soviet-controlled Baltic Sea, it was vulnerable to both aerial and naval attack from Soviet forces. As such, Bergen, their destination, had become the harbor of choice for delivering supplies to Scandinavia.
"It's going to be a long day."
"Yes, sir."
Seymour spared a glance at Smith, frowning.
"Well, we ought to show them how it's done. Let's make ready to depart by tomorrow morning at the latest. Shouldn't be long, and I'll be damned if we'll be the ones to hold up everything."
"Yes, sir."
Seymour half nodded, dismissing Smith, and turned back to the forward windows. 17 hours to Bergen. 17 hours for the Soviets to make it hell for them, if they chose to. With Danish airfields now in Soviet hands, it meant the whole North Sea was vulnerable to attack. Over-the-horizon missile attacks would steadily eat away at unarmed merchant ships, unless anti-aircraft vessels like Somerset stayed to protect them. For all the combined might of NATO, their position in Scandinavia was perilous. How many missed supply runs would it take for resistance to crack and fold? It was a question Seymour would rather never know the answer to. The supplies in this convoy were absolutely essential to continuing the fight. Food, fuel, ammunition, bandages, medicine, boots, uniforms, weapons, spare parts, and warm clothing. Seymour forced the dread from his mind. He wasn't accustomed to losing, and didn't intend to start now. He'd face the Soviets in the Adriatic, and it would be no different now. Let the Soviets hide in their naval bastion. They would grow weaker by the day, while the Allied fleets gathered in strength. Until the enemy was ready to run the gauntlet of Norwegian air support, they could do nothing. Battered and bruised, but unbowed, the Scandinavians fought on. So long as Norway still stood, the Soviet Navy was trapped. 3. The high-pitched howl of jet engines and the lingering scent of aviation fuel were welcome changes for Major Ken Morris.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?